Well, Mike, it's been over a month since Trump is back in power, Trump and his gang, and there are dozens of lawsuits that have already been filed, including by FBI agents who fear they're being purged for political reasons, and families who are concerned about new limitations on health care for transgender youth. And many are looking to the courts now to put some, as they say, guardrails. There's probably a better metaphor for that on this new administration, this aggressive administration. And a lot of these decisions seem to be more in the area of putting a hold on decisions, executive orders of the Trump administration. Let's start with your sense of giving us the lay of the land legally, and then we can maybe talk about specific cases.
Well, it's true, Jan. The only branch of government that gives us any hope is the judiciary, because the legislature has become completely supine. They grade themselves on how closely they're able to follow the executive branch of government. Trump completely owns them right now and will until for at least 2 years. So the last branch of government that's standing in the front of Trump's very conscious, very deliberate, and very thorough effort to take over every single part of the United States of America is the judiciary.
The judiciary encompasses quite a broad span of institutions from the Supreme Court down to local courts. Can you help us kind of locate the judiciary around some of these cases?
Let's do it by areas of concern. Let's start with the environment. Trump's first move was to get rid of the Paris Accords, to withdraw the U.S. from any and all worldwide environmental efforts to stop global heating. He has done everything he can to frustrate and inhibit the progress of electric cars in the United States. Drill, baby, drill is his motto. It's his guiding principle. If there's a single principle guiding him, that's it.
Of course, there's been a lot of drilling. The Biden administration was not very progressive on that front by many measures.
Yes, but they're going to look like radicals once you see how thoroughly Trump is trying to support fossil fuels. He's taken on single-use plastics, for example, and he's gotten rid of any and all efforts to inhibit the use of single-use plastics, despite the evidence that forever plastics are embedded in your brain and my brain, as well as everyone else's on the planet. So he's vehicles cause 28% of pollution, but he's completely ignoring that. He doesn't care about pollution. I think he loves the smell of gasoline. So there are judicial efforts to stop that in various ways. We've talked before about efforts to inhibit fossil fuel. There are efforts recently that have been successful in challenging the use of coal, which is the most polluting form of fossil fuels. In Louisiana and parts of the Midwest, the fact that coal is no longer economically viable has been overlooked by power companies. They have coal machines they want to run, even though it's totally uneconomic, that it's far cheaper to build now solar energy or wind energy than it is to use coal energy. And there have been successful lawsuits against them that require them to do the financial math in such a way that in the interest of their ratepayers rather than the people who are operating coal mines.
So, Mike, how much do state and local laws passed in opposition to the fossil fuel companies? I know there are many lawsuits, including in Oregon, that are still underway. How much power do decisions have by the executive branch in interfering with these local initiatives or local laws?
Well, that's being disputed all over the country, with some success here and there and failures elsewhere. Like in New Jersey recently, there was a setback when very good laws passed by the New Jersey legislature were found to be overrun and over-controlled by the federal judiciary, that their laws had no application because they interfered with matters that had been assigned to the feds. So the federal courts have jurisdiction, and the cases were removed from New Jersey's local courts to the federal courts, where they would find a much more hospitable environment for fossil fuel companies. But the same effort was made to get rid of California's ability to define pollution. And California has long been permitted to define its own definitions of what constitutes pollution. For various reasons, historically, the structure of the way the land is shaped in California, the way fumes can accumulate without the way the winds flow, the shape of the land, the geography, for a host of reasons, California has been allowed to go its own way. And about a third of the other states in the union have followed California and have adopted their standards. That's been in place for several decades. There have been efforts to reverse that. Trump, in fact, did reverse it in an executive order during his first term, but that was challenged legally and then withdrawn by the Biden administration. But now they're at it again. But there's recently a very good judicial decision in the District of Columbia Court of Appeals allowing California's to define its own definition of pollution. And actually, that's a very important decision, because it extends to, the whole idea of catalytic converters. It was this product of that legal choice made by California. The efforts to encourage electric vehicles will be really supported by that. So the whole question you raise of who's got the power? Do the local governments have the power? Do state governments? Is it all federal governments? Trump now is a much more conscious than he was in the first term. I think he was as shocked as anybody that he won. But now he's been expecting to win for a year or two, and he's got 1,000 conservative operatives who have made their way through every single branch of government in an effort to impose their ways. The book Project 2025 is a detailed account of environmental law, of criminal law, of First Amendment law, of reproductive rights law, of every single aspect of our life that's affected by government. So he had his team ready to go, and they've been hitting the ground running. And the issue then promptly becomes, how much power do they really have? To what extent do states and cities and counties run things? And those issues, in the broadest sense, they were addressed just last year by the U.S. Supreme Court in a case that reversed what was called the Chevron Doctrine, which a doctrine from the early 80s that said administrative agencies like the EPA can pretty much have their own way of things because Congress passes a general law saying that air should be cleaner, but the actual working out of that on a day-to-day basis is a complex matter that experts, as part of administrative agencies, should be given lots of room to impose whatever they think are the best ways to go.
That includes the disciplinary role of the EPA to force its decisions on industries.
Absolutely. That's exactly what it is about. The original case was one where the EPA had been forced by a lawsuit brought by the Natural Resources Defense Council, had
Just
been,
conservative.
it actually, it ran the other way. This was a case where the Natural Resources Defense Council had won a lawsuit charging that the EPA had to defer to an earlier ruling that their reach extended to anything that involved a possible impact, that would have a possible impact on air pollution. Like, for example, in an electric plant, if there's one smokestack that was particularly noxious, the EPA could require the owner of that smokestack to fix it. But there was a change once Reagan came in and the conservatives took over, and they had their appointments to the EPA, and the new EPA said, well, no, we only have power if it's an entire new product, a new power plant. And they were sued, and the Natural Resources Defense Council lost that suit. The EPA was allowed to have tremendous reach and redefine what it wanted to.
Which was a pr progressive decision in this case.
Very reactionary decision.
Okay. Okay.
Because the EPA wanted to limit its own reach, it said, we
The
only.
EPA wanted to limit its reach.
That's right. They said, we only have power if you're building a whole new plant.
Yeah.
If you have a modification or another, it's not our business. That's
Why would
in.
they want to limit their reach? Because it's a lot of work to sort through these decisions.
Because the oil companies want to be able to have their way with constructing power plants, and they want the EPA's reach to be very limited, and therefore they want to have its reach then confined only to major, undisputably huge enterprises, rather than, quote, micromanaging different parts of a power plant or have it reach in smaller ways. And so, therefore, it was a decision made by the EPA to limit its own actions. And they were sued because they said, hey, your job is to help the environment. These areas over here are having a measurable effect on the environment. You should be over here too. And the EPA said, no, we don't think so. And the Supreme Court said the EPA is right. The EPA gets to define what it can and can't do.
So there are often within these agencies conservative and more progressive bureaucrats.
Absolutely. And now everything is reversed. The Republicans now hate these administrative agencies. They believe that they've been captured by Obamaites and that they've become the deep state and they're something
They're all
noxious.
run by Marxists, I hear.
I hear that the only way to be safe is to eliminate them, to either, eviscerate them entirely or to limit their reach in every way possible. And they found a compatible Supreme Court. The Supreme Court reversed the Chevron doctrine last year. Chevron was, by the way, the defendant in the earlier case, and you can imagine, and Chevron got their way. So anytime a fossil fuel company gets its way, you can be sure that means increased pollution. Well, now with the Chevron doctrine has been overturned, which gives the executive branch of government more power, and their decisions cannot be questioned by judicial decisions as much as they could before. So there's battles all up and down counties, states, and federal agencies about who gets to say what goes on.
So, we've covered in recent years many of these civil suits against the fossil fuel companies, the oil industry, and they're in various phases. They move slowly. Is there a shift now with those cases that have been underway for a long time?
Not really. This is, unlike, say, immigration law, which has the executive branch, namely Trump, is able to immediately do things like fire immigration law judges, issue sweeping orders. It's clearly under the executive branch. The whole area of litigation about pollution moves much more slowly. And there was an effort by Exxon to go on the offense and to sue for defamation in California, people who were claiming that they were polluting the planet. And that effort lost, but there have been no really dramatic moves in the form of litigation in the area of the environment.
There are some states like California and to some extent Oregon and Washington that have more muscle in pushing back around these various regressive actions on the part of the Trump administration. Is that still the case that you'll be looking at certain states or jurisdictions where these cases have more potential legal leverage?
Absolutely. Just like Trump found his way to Lubbock, Texas, to have reproductive rights issues decided, Baltimore, Maryland has been the site of a judicial attack on the efforts to limit DEI or diversity. The whole concept of helping or acknowledging that Black people have been ever discriminated against. Trump is systematically trying to get rid of every single effort to overcome the effects of racism or to eliminate present racism. And litigation against that has found its way to Baltimore, which Maryland is a very progressive state comparatively. And environmental issues tend to come to California, Oregon. One of the first striking judicial victories was the state of Washington, the Western District of Washington, struck down Trump's effort to get rid of birthright citizenship.
And that's an area where it seemed that there was a pretty immediate decision there by a judge that stopped that in a profound way, or is it more just on hold until, or that's a temporary decision until it moves up to the higher courts and the Supreme Court.
It is a temporary decision, but I think it will last. And Trump's style here is very consistent. He's going to do things that seem to be outrageous, and it will be, but the effect of that will be to make other decisions seem more moderate, where if he'd have just done the more moderate ones, they would seem extreme. It's a classic technique. It's used by everybody. I mean, Martin Luther King was immeasurably helped by Malcolm X because people were afraid he was made to seem a moderate by comparison. And Trump's style is going to be to push out and do absolutely outrageous things that on their face have not a whisper of an opportunity to win for two reasons. One is one out of 100 of them actually will win, even though they seem impossible. But the other is to sort of act as cover for his other moves, which are, say, more debatable, more complicated. The kind of changes he might want to make that would be debatable would seem less extreme if he's got something that's really more extreme out there. So he's throwing mud on the wall to see what sticks, like the getting rid of birthright citizenship, even though there is in the text of the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution language saying anybody born in the United States is a citizen.
Yeah, the social scientists have this term, the radical flank phenomenon, where you have an extreme position that then redefines the more moderate, reasonable one. And one concern I have about portraying Trump as a fascist is that anything they do that's short of fascism can seem like a more reasonable or something we can live with. Do you have that worry that these extreme positions redefine what are more moderate, conservative decisions that nonetheless cause tremendous suffering and roll back of so much progress?
Well, exactly right. And Trump knows that intuitively, even though he's never read your experts, sociologists. And that's how he has always operated. He's a master at using the judiciary. He has been. He has always used it to the max. He never pays his subcontractors, for example. And some of them sue him, and they win a lot, but they don't win every time. And he's got a way of using the system of litigation. He knows that it can be used to intimidate. He knows there's a host of other reasons why you sue somebody other than expecting to get a monetary or injunctive relief. You do it to freak people out. You do it for a host of reasons. And
And consuming massive amounts of legal resources.
absolutely.
So you were talking about kind of on the environmental front, and things move slowly, and there's a pushback successful here and there. What about all of the attacks on the traditions of the legacy of affirmative action that was overthrown and much of that kept alive through DEI programs? What do you see happening on that front? That's also a very big reach, but a lot of it is rhetorical, right-wing rhetoric that has, of course, legal teeth to it, but some of it is basically racist, sexist kind of political rhetoric.
Well, much of it is within his power because it has been like a lot of corporations, when they think it's helpful to them, they will have DEI programs. And when they think DEI is stale and out of fashion, they'll get rid of them. They have no real investment in the content of their DEI programs. There has been litigation, like in Baltimore, particularly in Maryland, there are attacks against his general nationwide executive orders. But that's much of that is within the executive branch of government. It's not, strictly speaking, part of laws. There haven't been laws passed. Wherever there are laws passed, there is litigation. But so many of these programs have been voluntary ones or ones issued by administrators. And now those administrators have been replaced by other administrators. And there's no real legal challenges that have been very effective, I think, have been within the immigration law area. Here in Oregon, in Portland, there's been tremendous activity, not only in the courts against immigration, but in the streets and in people organizing. California, all over the country, there have been
There are a lot
real.
of these know your rights trainings. You see these little red cards being passed out, and I think it has also a way of being central to community organizing, even expanding the reach of who's a threat by not only ICE, but other actions on the part of the government, the potential actions that affect protesters, activists on campus, both those that are vulnerable because of their immigration status, foreign students, activist students. But I think there are a lot of alliances being formed around these threats. Can you speak to that as well?
Yeah, I think it's the most promising area of resistance right now is with immigration. And for one, the basic facts are that this country would have lost population last year were it not for immigrants. All these people are so concerned about America losing population should notice where the people who are in this country come from. And secondly, our economy would tank immediately without immigrants. At every level, at the most basic level, how many people are raising their child to work in a slaughterhouse? There are all kinds of nasty jobs, of uncomfortable jobs, all of which are being done now by people who immigrate to this country.
Farmers, of course, heavily depend on immigrant labor.
We would not be able to eat salad or breakfast without immigrant labor. It's that simple.
Some of that, though, like more of the threat to deport, I don't know, millions of people, more meant to frighten and intimidate and make it more difficult for undocumented workers to exercise their rights.
Well, of course it does, but they have a very tenuous existence already. But I think what's happened is that it has mobilized people, galvanized them in all kinds of ways. And this goes all the way up the economic chain. I mean, the smartest people, our AI hopes of competing with China are people who are basically from China, the leaders of the biggest companies, Microsoft, AI, OpenAI. There is a tremendous number of people who are foreigners who are working for our magnificently huge tech companies.
Didn't Trump offer for $1 million you can get a green card?
Yeah, he's done that. I think it's dawning on him that without immigrants, our tech companies wouldn't have a hope of surviving. China has steadily, for example, increased its educational program to where they're graduating far more scientists, far more engineers than we are. And they are very capable. The idea that China is stealing everything is the same as the idea that the Russians stole everything, which finally was disabused.
During the Cold War.
Yeah, exactly. Then this Sputnik happened, and we realized, well, we had not been able to put up a satellite, so maybe the Russians can actually think and reason and make stuff after all. And we're having, I think, a Sputnik moment now with China has come up with an AI program, DeepSeek, which is every bit as good as the programs developed for hundreds of billions of dollars expended in this country. So the immigrants are the story, the basic narrative of the United States is based on immigrants. And I think immigrants now are doing some of the most effective resistance to Trump. People who are supporting them, people who understand that not only is it human and moral, but it's also economically critical, that it's so important in every way for the whole demonization of immigrants to stop and for people, for the whole process to be put on a more rational basis of adding, there are people, you know, there may be reasons, there are good reasons not to want criminals in here, but the idea that every single immigrant is a baby raper, which is Trump's essential, you know, elect me message, is nonsense. It's beyond nonsense. And it has galvanized people very effectively here in Oregon, in Los Angeles. Even the LA Times has published a Know Your Rights page. Police, very conservative police departments, are not cooperating with ICE, because they're in touch with local business people and local academics and local people who do not want roaming federal immigration patrols to go into the schools, the churches, the other local institutions in order to arrest people.
Yeah, and teachers are announcing you do not have to open your classroom door during classroom when someone comes in. It's kind of shocking that these These principles have to be laid out. What about First Amendment rights? And that, I mean, that's in a different area, but it's certainly an alive one on campuses. A lot of universities are very afraid now of losing funding because of the use of the Title VI of the Civil Rights Act.
Sure.
State University is on a list of five universities that the Trump administration has decided to investigate without having had a complaint filed.
Right, because he is absolutely against the First Amendment. Trump is, he likes to suit which reporters will come and talk to him. He wants to eliminate demonstrations of every kind, particularly those against causes that he favors. He does not understand or appreciate it. It's where the word fascist comes closest to applying, I think, is the whole way in which people who resist him are treated. They're viewed, that resistance he regards as an unmitigated evil. The idea of give and take is something that means nothing to him. So he and his supporters have tried to eliminate in the state of Louisiana any effort whatsoever to demonstrate against any oil company. There are efforts being made now to limit the reach of public gatherings against his policies, and he hates nothing more than First Amendment expression of views that oppose his.
I'm continuing with that very dark part of the picture. We're seeing there are debates about how likely it is that the Trump administration could or would effectively be able to mobilize the military to suppress protests. It does not seem likely to me, from what I know, that the military leadership has historically not been keen on being used for political purposes against civilians in this country. The National Guard has historically, of course, Kent State, and there's this history of using the National Guard to suppress dissent. What do you think are reasonable fears in that area?
Well, Trump is trying to reshape the military to his own liking. He's fired people who are heading the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He does not want to be frustrated as he was by the military leaders who were in place the last time he was president. And they frustrated him. They didn't shoot any demonstrators. I mean, what are they for? So he wants to get a more pliant military. And it's true, the military has been very reluctant to ever engage in this country and with civilians in the United States itself. But that's not permanent. There's no law that says that every general has to feel that way. And Trump is rummaging through the generals looking for pliable ones, ones that will do what he wants them to do. And much of
These
what he
are very big agencies, like federal workers on the hopeful side. There have been lawsuits by unions of federal workers and resistances in a lot of these agencies. What do you think the role of lawsuits through federal workers' unions are in putting, which is partly through the judiciary, but through the muscle of big unions?
Well, officially, it's all they've got. So they've got to sue, they've got to litigate, and they have good grounds in many instances to litigate. Trump cannot just completely redesign the federal government. He can't get rid of everyone because the laws passed by Congress do require implementation of what the legislature has done. But they need help. Immigration is an excellent example. All the legal efforts to fight back are supported by actions in the streets, by people talking in the class. And if the courts sense a widespread shift in opinion or that the people are leaning in a particular way, that will certainly embolden many of the judges to do what they think is right.
What about the whole recent issues around overthrowing Roe v. Wade, the Dobbs decision that met a lot of resistance throughout this country, and a movement that was more active in support of reproductive rights than since the 70s.
That's a great example of what must happen if court decisions are to be as favorable as we want them to be, and if they are to have effect after they are decided.
Well, thanks for that sobering assessment. There's a lot. I think the lesson here is you use the tools you have, is what you've said before, legally, but it all depends on what we can mobilize on the streets and creative tactics of resistance.
Exactly.
Well, thanks. This is Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talking today about Trump and resistance through the courts.